Good morning and greetings in Jesus' name. It's good to be here and to worship together. What have you complained about this week? Have you ever met someone and you ask them how they are and they say, well, I can't complain? My usual response is to say, well, I sure could. Now, perhaps that deals with our personalities quite a bit. It seems you always find something to complain about, probably. This morning's message, the title is Complaining, the Cause, the Curse, and the Cure. Brother Jason talked about the seven C's at the Creation Museum. Well, I have four C's relating to complaining. Complaining, the cause, the curse, and the cure. What does it mean to complain? Well, we use different words. Sometimes we use words like murmur. Sometimes we use grumble. Sometimes we ask someone if they would like some cheese with their wine because they're whining. Sometimes children whine. Sometimes adults whine. And if some of you are sitting there thinking this is a good message for the preacher, you are correct. It's easy to preach about things that we're familiar with. What does it mean to complain? What means to express dissatisfaction or annoyance about something? It's usually fussing about something that's wrong. Complaining is also to express grief, pain, or discontent. It can also mean to make a formal accusation or a charge. Is it okay to complain? What do we complain about? All kinds of things. We can complain about what's for lunch. We can complain about the job that's to be done. We can complain about the studies that are to be studied at school. We can complain about the students. We can complain about the teachers. We can complain about the parents. And then we come to church and we can complain about the preachers, and the preachers go to ministers' meeting and complain about the parishioners. And then we go out into the work week and we complain about our boss, and the bosses complain about their workers. And everybody complains about the president, and the president complains about the people. If they would just buy electric vehicles, then we would solve the climate change. And the government leaders complain about the people that they're trying to govern. The Israelis complain about Hamas, and, well, that's maybe beyond complaining. And then we complain about the weather. We want it to be sunshiny when it is raining, and when it's raining, we wish the sun would finally shine once again. And we can never be satisfied. Turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verses 1 to 13. This is a New Testament passage where Paul gives us a little bit of insight, and he tells us why some things were written in the Bible previously. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he goes on this little dialogue about the children of Israel and why perhaps God has chosen to record things. I'm going to read verses 1 to 13 quickly. Moreover, brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Neither be ye idolaters, as some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day, 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all these things happen unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. There is no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. Now, there's three things I want to point out in this introductory passage. The first thing I want us to notice is that in verses 1 to 4, he uses the word all several times. This whole group of people all went through the exact same thing. And one of the things about complaining is that we tend to get this idea that I'm experiencing something that is very unique and it's special to me, and people should notice what's happening to me. And we somehow think that what I'm going through is a little different, maybe a little worse than most others around us. But Paul's reminding them that all these people went through the exact same things, okay? And also in verse 13, he tells us that there's no temptation taking you but such as is common. Nothing that we experience in life is actually really that different. Now, true, we do face different things, but nothing is really, we're not some unique person that is happening to have more than most of us, most of the people around us. And he's also telling us that while they all had the same opportunities, they all went through the same things, there was varying responses. Many of them, God was not well pleased. In fact, there was only two that left Egypt that actually made it to the doorstep of the promised land. Three, maybe. Joshua and Caleb. And then Moses, of course, got almost there. And then he's telling us that God has recorded Old Testament history for two reasons. One is that we can see God's attitude towards it, to learn a lesson from it, and that's the other reason, to learn the lesson and not repeat the same mistake. He said these things are written for us, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Those of us who are at the opposite end of history, as it were, take a lesson, okay? The first part of the message is divided into three parts, the cause, the curse, and the cure. The first part of the message, I want to look at the cause, the causes of complaining. Why do we complain? What instigates the complaining? Why? What kind of brings it up? Now, I'm not suggesting this morning that because there's causes, that lets us off the hook. What I'm saying is, like, what are the things that aggravate the complaining? And it's a fair question. It's a fair thing to look at, because I think as we look at what the causes are, then we can actually start to work at some of the solutions as well. And helps us to work through it. So cause number one, and I'm going to be going back now to the story of the children of Israel, looking at that period of time from the time they were in slavery in Egypt until near the end of their wilderness journeys. Flip over to Exodus chapter 15. The first cause of complaining is the lack of basic needs such as food and water. And in Exodus 15, there is the first incident where after they had come out of the land of Egypt, they had gone through the Red Sea, and it tells us in Exodus 15, verse 22, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. And the people murmured against Moses and said, "What shall we drink?" And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and then he cut it down, and the water was made fit to drink. But that was the first time where they came up against something where their basic needs were not met. They needed water. We need water. We need food. And there's also three other stories where they came up against this dilemma. Exodus 16, the next chapter, they took on their journey and they kept moving forward. 16, verse 2, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And they said, "Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and when we did eat bread to the full. For he had brought us into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." They had water, but they had nothing to eat. And rightly so. How many of us would sit blandly back and not be concerned if we had not food at all? But I want us to think about that. Now we're talking about things that are absolutely necessary for our survival. These are the reasons they murmured. Exodus 17, they murmured again. This is the time where they were again out of water. And God told Moses, he said, you go to the rock and you smite the rock. And he did that and water came out. But it tells us there that the people did chide with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. Not asking, but a demanding. They had a rightful need, but they complained. And then further along in their journeys in Numbers chapter 20, they again had no water, and it tells us there they gathered themselves against Moses and against Aaron, and they chode with Moses and said, would to God that we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. And that's when Moses got angry, and God had told him to go to the rock and speak to it, but Moses took his stick and he said, hear now, ye rebels, must I fetch water out of this rock? And he smote the rock, and it worked. Water came out, but God said, because you have done that, you're not going to be able to get into the land of Canaan. Because he broke the type, I believe. And I want us to remember this one thing. As we think about the lack of necessities creating a cause for complaining, our perspective of necessities, I believe, has been skewed by affluence. Stop and think sometime, what do you deem as absolutely necessary in your life? And I have a really good idea that what you would write down as what is necessity and what your grandparents would write down as necessity would look vastly different. And I don't know that we can do much about it. We find ourselves here in this land of plenty. We have lots of money, even though some days we think we don't. But our perspective of necessity has been skewed. The number two cause of complaining is hard circumstances. And I want to back up to Exodus chapter 5. You can turn there if you'd like. But this is while the children of Israel were still in Egypt. God had come to Moses and to Aaron. He said, go talk to Pharaoh. Let my people go. And so Moses and Aaron had started this process of endeavoring to get the people out of Egypt. And it tells us in chapter 5 and verse 20, I believe, that the leaders of the children of Israel, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood in the way as they came forth from Pharaoh. And they said unto them, the Lord look upon you and judge, because ye have made our savor to be abhorred in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to slay us. And what had happened there is that Moses and Aaron had went to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said, what? These people don't have enough work to do. They're trying to connive all things, kinds of things, like trying to figure out a way to go worship in the wilderness and so forth. And he said, make their work harder. Where you used to bring in wheelbarrows full of straw for them to work with, forget it. They have to go get their own straw. And then he would demand them to even make more bricks. And so a hard situation had become harder. And we face that in life. We think, like, life is going hard, and boom, all of a sudden something else. It's like, really? Now it's like we feel like things are beginning to be piled on us, and we're tempted to complain. The third cause for complaining is unmet expectations. In Numbers chapter 20 and verse 5, the people were talking to Moses here, and they said, wherefore have ye made us to come up out of Egypt to bring us into this vile place, this evil place? It is no place of seed, or of figs, or of vines, or of pomegranates, neither is there any water to drink. And I want us to think back. Back in Egypt yet, when Moses was telling them how to do the Passover and how to prepare to leave, he said, when you get into the land which floweth with milk and honey, you're going to need to keep doing this. So Moses had alluded to this fact that he's going to be taking them to a land that flows with milk and honey. And what did they get? All they got was a dry, hot, dirty journey with no food, very little food, same old boring food. Unmet expectations. And how many of us have gone into life expecting one thing, and we round the corner and calamity hits, and it's like the rug's pulled out from under our feet. Proverbs tells us that hope deferred maketh the heart sick. We know that feeling when our hopes just sink. We thought we're going to get good news. We thought we had rounded the corner, and not again. And it's a cause for complaining. Number four. The fourth cause for complaining is seemingly hopeless situations. Situations which, as we look at them, say, you know what, there is no way out of this. And it'll take us back to the incident of the Red Sea in Exodus 14. had come out of Egypt. The Bible tells us they came out with a high hand and they were on the way to the promised land until someone cried out, "Pharaoh's coming." What? And guess where they were? They were at a place where there was water ahead of them, a mountain on the left side, and a mountain on the right side, and Pharaoh's coming up the back. And what did they do? Same thing they always did. They said unto Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt with us to carry us forth out of Egypt?" And the grumbling and the complaining started. Here we are in a situation, we have no way out, we have no idea what's going to happen. In fact, all fingers are pointing towards the destruction again because we have nowhere to go and Pharaoh's coming up on our heels. Now they're telling themselves that it had been better to serve the Egyptians in Egypt. They said that in verse 12 of Exodus 14. "Is it not this that the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." But the Bible tells us that when they were in Egypt, their cry came up to God because they were sick and tired of laboring. That's the one experience. The other hopeless situation they faced is in Numbers chapter 14, and that's when they came up to the land of Canaan, and Moses sent out the 12 spies. They go spy out the land, and the 12 spies came back. Two of them were positive. The other 10 said, "There is no way we're going in there. The giants are too tall. The cities are too, the walls are too high. They're too thick. The people are powerful. There's no way we can do this." And what did they say again? "Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt. Or would God we had died in this wilderness." Why did God bring us out here to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return to Egypt? And they actually started talking among themselves, and they said, "You know what, forget Moses and Aaron. We're going to make ourselves a leader. Moses has no clue what he's doing. We're going to make ourselves a leader, and we're going to turn around, and we're going to go back to Egypt." And that's what complaining does. We get all focused on the bad thing, and our perspectives get all skewed and all messed up. What were they saying? They were saying that we want to turn around and go right back into the very thing we were crying out to God to deliver us from. In fact, by this time, God himself was ready to destroy them. He told Moses, "I will smite them with pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of thee a greater nation and mightier than they." And then Moses, of course, entreated for them, and God didn't move forward with that plan, but he did tell them that because of this, no one's going into the land of promise. You're all going to die in this wilderness. Because the path the Lord has chosen to develop his people is almost always humanly impossible and difficult, it can cause some people to freak out and desire to go back to their old life. These people didn't want to have to depend on the Lord this much in order to go forward. It's a hard life. We don't like it. We don't like when things get hard. We complain. In the hallway at school, there's a poster with a quote from Helen Keller, and it says this: "Character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, the vision cleared, ambition inspired, and success achieved." Much as we would like the pathway to be easy, it's not really the best for us, and God knows that sometimes. Number five cause is lust when basic needs are not met. We talked already how these children of Israel had basic needs. They had no water, they had no food, and God supplied those needs. And then we read later in Numbers chapter 11. This particular account actually talks about two murmurings. Chapter 11, verse 1, "The people complained, it displeased the Lord, and the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burnt among them, and consumed them that were in the uttermost parts of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed unto the Lord, the fire was quenched." This is reading out of Numbers 11. And Numbers 11, 4, it says, "And the mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting." Now, the mixed multitude, we believe, was part of the Some Egyptians had come along with them. So there was this mixture of God's people and people who were coming along. And this mixed multitude, it says, fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, "Who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic, but now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes." Complaining starts when we believe that we need more than the necessities. So what happened here is they had food, they had water, they were getting tired of it. Later in verse 8, it talks about how the people went about and gathered the manna. They ground it in mills and beat it in a mortar, and they baked it in pans. And I was letting my mind run a little bit. Like, think about one of your favorite foods for a minute, and supposing that everything but that one food was taken away from you, and that's what you had to eat for breakfast, for dinner, for supper, bedtime snack, breakfast, first break at school, lunch at school, after-school snack, supper. And it says they ground this in mills and beat it in a mortar. And I am wondering if there was children in those tents with the mortar and pestle and about day 27 of manna. And it's like, "Oh, this stupid manna." And then, you know, take a handful and throw it at your brother and splat. That was it. Manna, 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 manna. I was trying to, somewhere in my memory was a story that someone told or I read. We had met and had an acquaintance a few years ago, had went through the Great Depression. I think it was him, but I don't remember for sure. Talked about eating potatoes, because that was something they had, and they ate potatoes. How many ways can you make potatoes? Bake them, fry them, stir them, mash them. Pour milk on them, no milk, salt on them, more pepper. And I imagine most of us would start feeling fairly cynical about potatoes after a while. I was reading a little bit about some of the food in the Great Depression. And the hobos, that was the era when hobos would travel the rails. They were poor, they didn't have nothing to their name, and they would gather in hobo camps, and they would make this thing called mulligan stew, where they would find whatever roots they could, maybe steal a chicken somewhere and tear out some carrots out of the garden. They'd all come together and everybody threw something in, and they would put their pocket lint was one of the things they would throw in the stew to try to thicken it. I guess when you're desperate, they would also throw their cigarette butts in there because it would kind of flavor the stew. Now that was their own choice. There was a few other foods that came out of the Great Depression. Some we probably still do a little bit today. One was called Hoover Stew, which was macaroni and hot dogs and stewed tomatoes and maybe throw in some corn or peas. And I think probably most of us have had macaroni and cheese with hot dogs in somewhere along the line. But it was cheap food. One that I never heard of before was peanut butter with Or it was onion, baked onions with peanut butter stuffed in the center. I guess you got your protein and your flavor, I'm not sure. And then we go home and complain because the roast beef is tough. You know, we complain when our basic needs are met and we want more than that. We're lusting, okay? We want a nice spread, a nice big charcuterie board, all kinds of deli meats and cheeses, and we complain because there's no Colby Jack on the charcuterie board. Number six, the sixth cause is rebellion against God and the earthly authority he has set up. This comes from Numbers chapter 16, and it follows right on the heels of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. It's when Korah, Dathan, and Abiram came to Moses and said, "Why do you take so much upon you? Why do you think you and Aaron need to be the leaders? Look at this whole congregation of men. Is not this whole congregation holy? Let's just have breath. Let's just have everybody lead out. Why do you think you're..." And what did Moses do? Did he react and just slay them? No, he went to God. And God said, "Call them to the door of the tent and stand back." And they did that, and the earth opened up and swallowed up them and their families. And it tells us The next day, verse 41, Numbers chapter 16, verse 41, I'm going to read this. But on the morrow, all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron, saying, "Ye have killed the people of the Lord." And it came to pass, when the congregation was gathered against Moses and against Aaron, they looked toward the tabernacle of the congregation, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. And Moses and Aaron came before the tabernacle of the congregation, and the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, "Get you up from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell upon their faces. And Moses said unto Aaron, "Take a censer and put fire therein from off the altar, and put on incense, and go quickly into the congregation and make an atonement for them, for there is wrath gone out from the Lord. The plague is begun." And Aaron took as Moses commanded and ran unto the midst of the congregation, and behold, the plague was begun among the people, and he put on incense and made an atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stayed. Now they that died in the plague were 14,700, besides them that died about the matter of Korah. So the day before, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram and their families went down in the earth. The next day the people said, "Look what the preachers did. Look what the leaders did." And they complained and they were fussing about this. God became angry and a plague started to sweep through that congregation. It's so easy for us to be critical at leadership and believe that somehow what they did was wrong, when actually all the leadership did was follow the leading of the Lord, and we forget that. Maybe we look at something our parents did and say, "That wasn't right." Maybe they had prayed and asked God what to do, and that's what God said to do. Look at the teacher. Look at the ministry or anybody in leadership. Maybe we look at a committee and say, "Why did they do that?" Maybe they prayed about it, and that's exactly what they felt they should do. And we, with our superior wisdom, I'm sure, look at it and criticize it. How does God feel about that? And the last cause for complaining, number 7, is when we focus on the way instead of our leader and destination. Numbers 21 and verse 4, "And they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way." They got their focus all down. Like, "This is hard, this is horrible, this is dirty, it's hot, and there's snakes," and whatever they were fussing about. "And they spake against Moses and against God, 'Where have you brought us out to die?'" One of their reoccurring themes. "Why did you bring us out here to die? There's no bread, no water, and our soul loatheth as light bread." So it wasn't actually true that there was no bread. They had the manna. But that's how we do. We exaggerate. "We don't have nothing to eat. There's nothing to eat in this house." Meanwhile, the pantry's full, and there's jars of canned goods. The refrigerator's full. In fact, there's probably food at the back of the refrigerator rotting. There's nothing to eat in the house. How many have houses like that? If you have children and men, that's the way it is, right? There's just nothing to eat. Because what we want isn't there. And we'll look at this story in a little bit, because this particular time, this is where God sent the snakes out, start biting people, and people are dying. And that actually is the last time we have record of them complaining. But we'll look at that later. Second part of the message, the curse. Is complaining okay, or is it a sin? And we don't have time to look at this, but there's two passages we could go to. One is with David. The other one is Job. And they both talk about bringing their complaint to God. Job talks about opening his mouth in complaint. But the Bible tells us that he sinned not. So perhaps there's a way to complain and not sin. Is it okay to express dissatisfaction or annoyance about something to God? Is it okay to express grief, pain, or discontent to God? Is it okay to make a formal accusation to God? Something we need to think about. But as you meditate and think about the life of David and the life of Job, and you think about them complaining, there's one very stark difference between that and what we just looked at with the children of Israel. The children of Israel, almost every time they come against, like, "Look at this. And they're standing there not ready. They're not going to lift a finger. They're not going to do a thing about it. It's just like, you are wrong. Look at you, God. Look at you, Moses. And they just hold it out there and put it in their face, and that's it. When you look at the situation of Job and David, yes, they constantly, oh, this is how I feel, God. This is all wrong. But blessed be the name of the Lord. The humanity of them comes out, and they share it to God, but then they walk away and say, but in spite of all that, God is my rock, and I'm going to trust in him. Job said, naked came I forth out of my mother's womb, and naked will I return. Blessed be the name of the Lord. They had this picture of God, and they realized the sovereignty of God in the whole thing. And I think that's one of the key differences to whether complaining becomes a curse in my life or not. Complaining becomes a curse when, and I have six points under this. Number one, complaining becomes a curse when my basic needs are met and I want more. When our basic needs are met and we demand more, we fail to recognize the blessings we already have, and we fail to recognize that my core needs are taken care of, and we fail to thank God for that. Number two, complaining becomes a curse when we are discontented with our lot in life. Whatever situation we find ourselves in, we're just discontent with it. It's like, it's not right. It shouldn't be this way. It should be different. And we complain. That's a curse. Number three, complaining becomes a curse when we falsely accuse others and God. Just like the children of Israel pointed their fingers at Moses and said, you killed the people of the Lord. That wasn't true. Those people chose to rebel against God, and God punished them. That was the truth. They pointed fingers at God, they pointed fingers at Moses, and ascribed wrong motives. God, you're the one that brought us out in this wilderness just to die, and that wasn't true. God wanted to bring them out of Egypt, teach them a lesson, and then take them to a land of promise, if they had only would only follow. Becomes a curse when we falsely accuse others and God. Number four, complaining becomes a curse when I focus on me and my problem rather than Almighty God. When I focus on me and my problem rather than Almighty God. We look at the children of Israel and say, how could you ever do that? Like, you just came through a Red Sea 3 days ago. God parted the waters, you walked through on dry ground, killed all the Egyptians, and we say, why couldn't you see it? But we're the same way. So quickly, we lose focus. Number five, complaining is a curse when we are a negative influence on others. And I go back to the story when the people complained to Moses that second time about the water, and Moses like, all right, here you go. Bam, and hits the rock. And I often wonder about that. It's like, it was Moses' fault, right? But don't you just want to take those people and, like, so you aggravated this man, and he flew off the handle, and now he stays out of the promised land. Everybody is responsible for their own actions, but we play a big part in how we influence other people. Becomes a curse when we are a negative influence on others. Number six, complaining becomes a curse when we are unwilling to be a part of the solution. When we stand aloof and point fingers and expect someone else to fix it. Complaining is a curse when we are unwilling to be a part of the solution. Last part of the message yet, the cure for complaining. I want you to turn to Numbers chapter 24. Like I said before, this is the last reference to them complaining. They weren't necessarily angels after this. After this, we have the time where they went turned after Baal Peor and so forth. But it's the last story we have of them coming to Moses and complaining. Numbers chapter 21, and I'm going to read verses 4 to 9. Starting in verse 5. They were much discouraged, by the way, in verse 4. And the people spake against God and against Moses, "Wherefore have you brought us up out of the land of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loatheth this light bread. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, 'We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray thee unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us.' And Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said unto Moses, 'Make thee a fiery serpent and set it upon a pole. And it shall come to pass that every one that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live.' And Moses made a serpent of brass and put it upon a pole. And it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived." And they moved on. Couple of things about this story. Number one is that they recognized that they were wrong. They came to Moses and said, "We've sinned. We spoke against God and we spoke against you. Ask God to take these serpents away." And the interesting thing is, unlike sometimes before, God didn't just stop. God said, "All right, here's what I want you to do, Moses. I want you to get a bunch of brass, hammer it into the form of a snake, get yourself a pole, and you put this snake up on the pole, and you tell the people that they have to look at that to live." Now, what was the big deal about that? Like, what was... Well, Jesus told us what the big deal was. He told Nicodemus in John chapter 3, "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life." The children of Israel now recognize that their complaining was a sin. And the only way to be free from that was to look at the provision. That was the brass snake on the pole. The only way for us to be cured is to realize that complaining is a sin against God and look to Jesus. When viewed as a sin, we realize that it needs to be repented of, needs to be fought against, and replaced with something in order to find victory. Paul talks about putting off the old man and putting on the new. Christian life is work. We don't just, yes, as Brother Clyde's devotion said, we are born again and we get the new father, but it takes work. We have some choices to make. We need to replace complaining with something else, and I have five things to replace complaining with in conclusion. Five things as we realize that complaining is a sin against God. What can replace it? Number one, replace it with thankfulness. A few days ago, we had a little discussion in school about which holiday is the most important. And of course, two holidays came up. One was Christmas and one was Easter. Nobody said anything about Thanksgiving. I'm not sure why. And I've been pondering that. While it's true that Thanksgiving and Easter kind of, not Thanksgiving, Easter and Christmas are based upon a happening, an event concerning Jesus Christ, I wondered almost if Thanksgiving isn't even more important. Because with Christmas and Easter, as we discussed that, it became clear to me that the reason people were voting for Christmas because that it was more fun. We have gifts and family gatherings and all kinds of fun things. And we decided that if we would do those things at Easter, then Easter would probably be the most important. So we kind of focus on the wrong things, perhaps. Is Thanksgiving an important holiday or isn't it? Well, we can't go back to the Bible and say, well, it's because of a Christian. No, it's not. But the Bible tells us twice about people that weren't thankful, and both of those God is bringing judgment on. One is in Romans, where it talks about how people were given over to a reprobate mind, and it tells us there that they were not thankful. That was one of the characteristics of people that are given over to a reprobate mind, they're not thankful. And then Paul tells Timothy there that when he's talking about the end times, a couple of characteristics of end time people, and one of those is that they're unthankful, right up there with unholy. I sort of think maybe Thanksgiving is the most important. We like to take pills or something that cures a lot of things. I saw an ad yesterday that the doctor was, he was focused on a certain thing, and it, he had a whole list at the top. You know, if you have this, 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 and this, then I can probably help because it's probably this. You know, we like the silver bullet to just take one of these twice a day, and that's Thanksgiving. The Bible gives us over 300 references to thanks, Thanksgiving, and praise. Thanksgiving takes the focus off of me and onto God. Thanksgiving remembers how God worked before, and Thanksgiving gives God his rightful place. Number two, the second thing to replace complaining with is contentment. 1 Timothy 6:8, and having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. Hebrews 13:5, let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Contentment takes what we have and makes it enough. Number three, third thing to replace complaining with is to trust in the sovereignty of God. Psalm 55, verse 22, cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. Psalm 142, this is a psalm of David, and he's crying out to God. In verse 2, he says, I poured out my complaint before him. I showed before him my trouble. And then in verse 5, he says, I cried unto thee, O Lord. I said, thou art my refuge and my portion in the land of the living. David was taking his focus off his problem and putting it onto God. He said, God, you're the one that can take me through. God told Paul, he said, my grace is sufficient for thee. My strength is made perfect in weakness. When we find ourselves being weak, that's when God can work. I mentioned Job before. Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And later in the book he said, but he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. It's that exercise of looking at our situation and realizing that God has a purpose in this, and we're going to follow God no matter what. Fourth thing to replace complaining with is speech that is positive and uplifting. Proverbs 10:11, the mouth of a righteous man is a well of life. Y'all know what it's like. Terribly thirsty, finally get a good drink. Maybe you're away from home, you want a good drink, and the water there is just, it doesn't taste like the water at home. And when you finally get, you come home, I've heard it already, it's like, oh, finally some good water. Part of it's because what we're used to. Water that's coming out of our mouth, is it a well of life, or does it tend to discourage other people? Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. And number five, finally, is a willingness to be part of the solution. I think it was Brother Nelson that used to say, don't complain about it unless you're willing to do something about it, or something along that line. And I haven't forgotten that. You know, it's easy to stand back and criticize and whine and complain and fuss about something. Have we stopped and thought about, can I do something about it? Sometimes there is something we can do. Maybe it's a situation in the church or whatever. Like, what can I do about it? Maybe it is a relationship. Maybe that other party is ridiculous. And we tend to think it's all their fault. Maybe there's something I can do about it. Numbers chapter 21, if you're there yet, you can look down further in verses 16 to 18. It tells us that from thence they went to Beer, that is the well whereof the Lord spake unto Moses, gather the people together, and I will give them water. And then it says, then Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, sing ye unto it. The princes digged the well, the nobles of the people digged it, by the direction of the lawgiver with their staves. Now instead of whining and complaining, they were like, God brought us here. Look at this. And they sang a song, and it alludes to the fact that somebody was digging. Not sure what they're all meaning by that, but it sounds almost like God led them to a place, and they started digging, and they discovered, hey, there's water, and they kept digging, and they supplied their own need. Rather than sitting back, waiting for God to do something, they were willing to be part of the solution. Let's be thankful people. Focus on the good things we have in life. It's so easy to forget. But let's not forget, too, what God thinks about it when we do start to whine and complain. It's a good reminder for all of us to How must God feel when he looks down and says, you know, I gave them all that. They have all that, and they're fussing about this one little thing over here. Paul says these things were written for our admonition, and we know how God felt about it. There was times God was ready to just, like we do with a fly. Wow. May God help us. Let's pray.